generosity is to offer one's own life. And so Imam Ali alayhi salam, by lying in the bed of the Holy Prophet Muhammad on the Laylatul Mabit, he sacrificed his life for the sake of the Messenger of Allah. Now, just a quick recap about Laylatul Mabit. This is the night when the Quraysh tribes, the pagans of Mecca, they wanted to assassinate the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And so their plan was to assassinate him in the middle of the night while the Prophet was sleeping. And so the Prophet then, by the revelation and inspiration given to him by Allah, decided to migrate from Mecca to Medina. Now, in order for him to be able to safely migrate, he needed somebody to stay in the bed so that the pagan Meccans of the Quraysh tribes would not be able to capture him. And it is here that Imam Ali alayhi salam offered his life and offered to sleep in the bed of the Prophet so that the Prophet's life could be saved. Now, Ibn Athir reports that the Quranic verse, which can be found in chapter number 2, verse 207, "And among men is he who sells himself to seek the pleasure of Allah." Ibn Athir says that this verse was revealed about Imam Ali when the Holy Prophet left Mecca for Medina and had requested Imam Ali to lie in his bed and to transfer the people's trust to them the next day. And so, dear friends, Imam Ali was truly the most generous person after the Holy Prophet, for he lay in the Prophet's bed and sacrificed his own life for the Holy Prophet, preferring the life of Prophet Muhammad. A beautiful and profound lesson that we should sacrifice our lives if it means the safety of Islam. Brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
You for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil. And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, "Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger."
يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
The fasting of the month of Ramadan is an important pillar of our faith. And all physically fit and mature Muslims are required to fast every day of this month of Ramadan. Fasting is not unique to Islam. It is there in Christianity, in Judaism, even in Hindu and Buddhist tradition. There is this tradition of fasting. One of the important things about the month of Ramadan is the issue of reciting the Holy Quran. Our holy book, it is a book which was revealed to the Prophet in this month of Ramadan. And it has a very close connection with that. You know, Muslims around the world during the evening time, now that it is summertime, so before even the prayers, we have gatherings here where people sit in different circles, adults, young, and children, where they recite the Quran, our holy book. And they recite it in the Arabic language. The amazing thing is that majority of the Muslims do not come from the Arabic background. The largest Muslim country in the world is not in the Middle East. It is in the Far East, Indonesia. But the majority of Muslims around the world, even though they do not understand Arabic, they cannot speak Arabic, but they learn how to read the Holy Quran in the Arabic script. According to what I know, I think this is the only book in the world read by millions who do not understand what they are reading. Of course, translations are available in English and major languages of the world. We have many programs in the month of Ramadan where people study the Quran, go through the commentary of the Quran. So studying the Quran is very important. But to maintain the original language of the Quran is as important for us as studying the Quran itself. And so Muslims around the world learn how to read the Quran in its original language. And another important tradition of the month of fasting is the dua, prayers, where we have special prayers from our Prophet and the Imams from his family, where we recite during different nights. And one of the prayers actually is very relevant to the theme of the social dimension of fasting. But then the major part of the prayer is about others, concern for other people in the society. It's only at the end that we come, only three sentences, where we pray for ourselves. So even these prayers that we have are indirect way of teaching us that we should not only pray for ourselves and think about ourselves, we have to be concerned about the other people in the society.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Around the World with Reporters.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said that Moscow consistently defends international law and at the same time will firmly defend its national interests to ensure the safety of its people. He made the remarks during a speech to thousands of soldiers and veterans on Red Square during the annual parade, which marked the 76th anniversary of victory in the World War II.
Our people know too well how this can end. Russia is consistently defending international law while continuing to protect our national interests and the security of our people. Our guarantees are the glorious Russian armed forces, descendants of the victorious troops, and of course our joint efforts for the sake of our country's development and the well-being of Russian families.
Vladimir Putin voiced concern over what he described as a creeping return of ideologies of the time when slogans of racial and national superiority, of anti-Semitism and Russophobia became even more cynical.
Unfortunately, attempts are made to deploy a large part of Nazi ideology and the ideas of those who were obsessed with the delusional theory of their own supremacy. This ideology is not only supported by radicals and international terrorist groups of all kinds.
The parade was participated by more than 12,000 troops, 191 units of military ground equipment, and 76 planes and helicopters. Military parades and festive events commemorating the Soviet victory took place in almost all Russian cities.
I consider the Victory Day as the greatest holiday of Russia. Many Russians lost their life to liberate Europe. Victory is victory, and it was very, very difficult. This is a great day for the Soviet people. Our republics of the Soviet Union won a great victory. Some powers are seeking to distort history. They say that the victory was won by the Americans, French, or Britons. It's a lie.
This year's parade comes at a time when Moscow's relations with the West are severely strained over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine and the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov warned last week that relations between the Kremlin and Washington could plunge to the Cold War level if Washington continued to reject dialogue with Moscow.
The Soviet Union lost about 27 million people, 40% of all human losses in the World War II. A significant part fell on the civilian population of the country. According to the Soviet Extraordinary State Commission for the Establishment and Investigation of the Atrocities of the German Fascist Invaders, about 2,000 cities and towns, over 70,000 villages in the USSR were completely or partially destroyed by the occupiers. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Indian-administered Kashmir witnessed the death of one of its prominent pro-freedom leaders in an Indian-run jail this week. Ashraf Zarrahi's death has raised concerns about the scores of political prisoners languishing in Indian prisons as the country combats a fresh surge in coronavirus cases and deaths. That amid testimonies by members of the 78-year-old's family who said he died due to lack of health care and improper prison conditions after he tested positive for coronavirus. Now families of other political prisoners fear they could also face Zarrahi's fate. The father of the 19-year-old Seher Shabir has spent 33 years of his life in different Indian detention centers. Shabir Shah is in prison for actively supporting Kashmir's right to self-determination.
My father's health conditions are not really good, and I and my family fare a lot in this case because he's having already many serious health ailments, and his life is in danger because we can't take the risk right now as COVID is increasing day by day and he has been denied treatment. Also, apart from all this, we have no contact with him.
Sahar's father is among scores of Kashmiris who are imprisoned for supporting the region's independence from Indian rule. They are incarcerated under India's Public Safety Act, a preventive detention act that authorizes detention of any person for up to 3 months without a trial, and the detention period is extendable. Rights groups say the law has often been exploited to keep pro-independence supporters behind the bars. Human rights activist Ehsan Untu was also jailed recently. He says the central government has made it difficult to bail prisoners out.
The treatment of Kashmiri political prisoners in India is unfair. We are often kept with the criminals and are denied basic health care and medical attention. The entire setup is against Kashmiri prisoners. Even courts do not hold fair hearings. The international community must take action. Otherwise, no Kashmiri will walk alive from Indian jails.
Due to the raging pandemic last year, India's top court handed the decision to release prisoners on interim bail to the powerful state committees. Around 45,000 prisoners were released under the guidelines. However, not many of them were from among Kashmiri political prisoners. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Tens of thousands in Paris, more than 100,000 all over France, took the street in a massive protest against the climate law voted earlier this week in the French Parliament. The demonstrations took place in a festive atmosphere with a lot of colors and animation and with a lot of young people coming from different social backgrounds. The awareness is rising and more people are getting convinced that significant measures have to be taken to save the planet. But that's not what the French authorities are doing, they say.
This law is ridiculous because the President of the Republic promised 150 climate measures. Finally, only 29 were retained. Regarding domestic flights, thermic efficiency of apartments and renewable energies, this is really the minimum of the minimum. Our group in the Senate will oppose this law next month. We are going directly to a catastrophe if more urgent measures are not taken.
Earlier this week, the French Parliament voted a climate law after 110 hours of debate, a record. The main points of the law are ban of domestic flights if the distance can be done by train in less than 2 hours, ban of renting very poorly isolated apartments, stimulating the use of especially electrical bicycles. But this is far from being enough for the more than 600 associations who organized these marches and who consider French President Macron responsible for the passivity on climate issues.
A real planification should be made to leave the nuclear energy behind us and to invest in renewable energy. This government does not have a budget for the thermic isolation of poorly isolated apartments, and it should really ban domestic flights and develop transport by train instead of privatizing the public transport. There should be taxes on big multinationals to create thousands of jobs in the development of renewable energy. Even Joe Biden in the USA has proposed these kinds of measures.
The High Council for the Climate, an independent body, declared that the French measures are insufficient to reduce greenhouse gases. The European Union as well is strengthening its ambitions to halt global warming. So, time for France to increase its objectives. But to succeed, the French authorities will have to hurt the big bosses of the nuclear and the petrol industry. It is not sure that they are willing to go that far.
Too little and maybe too late. That's the main sentiment here concerning the climate measures taken by the French Parliament. In June, the Senate will discuss the same text, and this citizen movement is very determined to keep the pressure high. President Hunt, Paris.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge in Indian-administered Kashmir, Mohammad Afaq Saeed has been swamped with distress calls from people looking for oxygen. Afaq leads the oxygen campaign of a Srinagar-based NGO. His small team of dedicated volunteers is working round the clock to help COVID patients gasping for breath.
We have one of the biggest oxygen programs in this region in Kashmir. We have a lot of oxygen cylinders and a lot of oxygen concentrators, then non-invasive ventilation machines and other supportive equipment. So this way, a lot of pressure from hospitals has been released.
With the Himalayan region's healthcare system reeling under tremendous pressure, Good Samaritans and social organizations have come forward to extend helping hand to people in need. Athrood Kashmir, a prominent philanthropic organization based out of Kashmir's summer capital, has converted the region's Hajj House into a spacious 100-bed COVID center. The facility aims to cater to the rising number of COVID patients requiring hospitalization.
We have established this facility in collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high-flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit, and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, Good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Saidali Safid, Indian Administered Kashmir.
According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, nearly 200 civilians were killed and some 400 others were injured following the Taliban's increasing attacks since the beginning of the fasting month of Ramadan.
As the statement says, most of the victims were targeted either by roadside bomb blasts, car bomb attacks, or targeted assaults. This comes as intense fighting is underway between the Afghan National Army and Taliban militants across some key provinces in southern and northern parts of the country.
Meanwhile, top military officials in Kabul say that counter-attack operations conducted by Afghan government forces have claimed the lives of nearly 1,000 Taliban militants over the same period.
The resolute and quick response of our brave armed forces defeated Taliban in the battles in key districts, mainly in Kandahar and neighboring Helmand province in southern parts of Afghanistan. This is why they use roadside bombs and car bomb attacks as new tactics to resist. Of course, they will fail.
While the Afghan government and the Taliban are struggling to have the upper hand on the battlefields, local Afghans continue to view the controversial Afghan peace talks as the only possible way for bringing calm and security to their war-ravaged country after years of instability.
Decades-long war in our countries prove that there would be no victory for anybody through militarism. Both sides should forget about war and continue to negotiate as a logical way for ending the misery in our nation.
Recently, U.S. Special Envoy for Afghanistan Zalmay Khalilzad said the Taliban have shown a green light to the Istanbul summit on the Afghanistan peace process. The summit was scheduled for April 24th, but it was postponed after the Taliban refused to attend it amid postponement of the withdrawal of the U.S. troops from Afghanistan. And a peace deal between Washington and the Taliban signed in the Qatari capital, May the 1st, was designated as the deadline for the U.S. troops pullout. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine held a press conference warning that Israeli regime will face retaliatory measures over its ongoing attacks in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance in the Gaza Strip marked Saturday as a day of popular rage along the border fence, where the resistance announced a return of military clashes with the Israeli army and firing incendiary balloons toward Israel in response to the crimes committed in Jerusalem al-Quds.
What is happening in Jerusalem al-Quds is systematic apartheid policy that aims to demolish the Palestinian cause. The recent eviction of Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah is totally refused by Palestinians. So the resistance in Gaza announces the return of clashes on the borders and calls for a new uprising if these violations continue.
In a recent speech, resistance leaders warned that Israel should bear the responsibility over the recent attacks against Palestinian residents in occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds, saying the resistance is ready to defend Jerusalem with all means.
We hold the Israeli regime responsible for the consequences of the crimes in Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian resistance won't sit idle against the killing and eviction of Palestinians. Jerusalem is our red line. All Palestinian groups are united in responding to these crimes, and the response will be heavy.
Palestinians called on the international community and all Muslim nations to support Palestinians and do actions to stop the Israeli violations of Palestinians and the ongoing attacks of the holy places in Jerusalem.
Palestinians are all united in the face of these Israeli crimes. We are calling on Islamic nations to stand by Palestinians and stop these Israeli violations. Our main goal is protection of the holy city.
Palestinian worshippers clashed with the Israeli regime late Friday at Al-Aqsa Mosque in an escalation of weeks of violence in Jerusalem. Palestinian resistance here holds the Israeli regime responsible for the attacks against Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, announcing they are ready to respond. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Muslims across Italy have virtually observed and taken part in the International Al-Quds Day on Saturday, the day after the last Friday in the holy month of Ramadan. A commemoration was held in the form of a video conference titled Jerusalem Al-Quds. The initiative was attended by authoritative figures from the Islamic community in Italy. The virtual gathering sent out a strong message of undivided solidarity with the people of Palestine in demanding self-determination, independence, and dignity.
Since 1948, the Zionist entity has embarked on a program of oppression of Palestinians, cancellation of our history, culture, art, and architecture, a program of ethnic cleansing. Jerusalem is our stronghold and the capital of Palestine. It's time for the international community to address the normalization deals signed by some Arab countries, which is an act of war against us.
Video conference speakers stressed the fact that as the occupation in Palestinian territories continues, the Israeli occupiers are annexing more areas, killing more civilians, crushing all political resistance, and shutting down free press. This comes amid the growing indifference of the international community.
The Italian media have increasingly failed to report on the Palestinian struggle over the past years. On Thursday, the Italian Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio met with his Palestinian counterpart Riyad Maliki in Rome, but the encounter went utterly unnoticed by the media.
Over the past years, we have recorded a growing lack of attention to the Palestinian struggle. There appears to be a plan to eradicate humanity from our existence. It is so much easier to control people with no humanity, and the COVID crisis has made this process much smoother.
Al-Quds Day was first introduced by Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979 and has become an annual affirmation of the Muslims' solidarity with the people of Palestine in the struggle for the liberation of Jerusalem Al-Quds. Max Civili, Rome.
The Turkish health minister said the number of new infected cases with the coronavirus has declined due to lockdown measures imposed by the government over the past 15 days. Fahrettin Koca also said the decline was also seen in the number of fatalities. Turkey has been under lockdown since April 29th in an attempt to curb the spread of the virus. The lockdown will last till May 17th, with only tourists and those working in critical jobs allowed to move. The government introduced those measures after the daily infected numbers hit 60,000 cases per day. The health minister said more than 10 million people in the country have been given the second dose of the vaccine, with more than 14 million others receiving their first dose.
Turkey has inked agreements for a total of 240 million doses of the coronavirus vaccines developed by the Chinese firm Sinovac, Pfizer-BioNTech and Russia's Sputnik V.
The Turkish health minister announced previously that if the daily number of infections does not reach 5,000 per day, new measures are to be implemented. Analysts say that the government must take things slow and not risk opening the country again, even if this could affect the economic situation.
Despite the optimism of our health minister, his remarks show that the number of daily infections has still not reached the number set by the government, which is 5,000 to reopen the country. So I think with the data we have now, the country may go into another lockdown after May 17th, especially that the number of those vaccinated is nearly 25% of citizens.
Looking at the latest numbers given by the health ministry, it seems that Turkey must continue with the lockdown to decrease the numbers of daily infections. However, the vice president has already nulled any extension of lockdown. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
As COVID-19 cases continue to surge in Indian-administered Kashmir, Mohammad Afaq Saeed has been swamped with distress calls from people looking for oxygen. Afaq leads the oxygen campaign of a Srinagar-based NGO. His small team of dedicated volunteers is working round the clock to help COVID patients gasping for breath.
We have one of the biggest oxygen programs in this region in Kashmir. We have a lot of oxygen cylinders and a lot of oxygen concentrators and non-invasive ventilation machines and other supportive equipment. So this way, a lot of pressure from hospitals has been released.
With the Himalayan region's healthcare system reeling under tremendous pressure, Good Samaritans and social organizations have come forward to extend helping hand to people in need. Athrod Kashmir, a prominent philanthropic organization based out of Kashmir's summer capital, has converted the region's Hajj House into a spacious 100-bed COVID center. The facility aims to cater to the rising number of COVID patients requiring hospitalization.
We have established this facility in collaboration with state administration. The facility has 28 beds with high flow oxygen capacity and 72 beds with oxygen supply. We will add 100 more beds here with oxygen support system very soon.
As hospitals are scrambling to shore up oxygen supplies, the authorities have decided to install over 30 new oxygen generating plants in the region. Also, the government is constructing a 500-bedded COVID hospital in central Kashmir's Budgam district.
The work on this project is to be completed within 35 to 40 days. The hospital will have 125 beds as intensive care unit and rest of the beds will have oxygen supply system.
Meanwhile, COVID cases continue to pile up in Kashmir, with almost 5,000 cases and 50-plus deaths being reported on a daily basis. Authorities have already extended the lockdown in the region.
As second wave of COVID-19 pandemic continues to take toll on healthcare system here, experts believe the worst is still ahead. Amid the unprecedented surge of the infections, Good Samaritans are lending a helping hand to the needy, even as fear and anxiety loom large. Sayyidli Safit, Indian administered Kashmir.
IRIB English Radio presents The Month of Allah. Let's be with Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
As I look to nature's beauty, dazzled am I, knowing everything calls on you, the Lord Most High.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to the program Month of Allah. We were talking about brotherhood and the fact that we have other obligations, not only limiting ourselves to just spirituality, only limiting ourselves to our obligation towards God. We also have obligations to the creation of God. If a person only focuses on one part of spirituality or one part of religion, it can be like a person that has, for example, a caricature of a person that has a very big ear or, say, a very big nose, meaning they have only focused on one part of their deen and one part of their religion. For us to be complete, it is very important for us to make sure that all parts of our religion and all dimensions of our religion are complete. And of those parts is brotherhood, that we should be very careful with the obligations that we have towards our fellow brothers. We should be very careful of the unity that we have, and we should always preserve unity amongst the Muslims. No matter what sect they are, no matter what part of the world they are from, we should solidify ourselves. And we all have one cause, and our cause is, inshallah, for us to reach God Almighty. It's important for us to know that the Imams, the Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam, they can be displeased with us with the way that we disrespect our brothers, the way that we treat our fellow brothers. In a narration, it says that a group of people, they came to the 8th Imam, Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, alayhi salam. And for a period of time, they were waiting to see him, but the Imam did not want to see them. And then when they finally met him, they asked him, "How come you don't allow us to see you? How come you didn't allow us to see you?" And there the Imam told him that basically it is because of these following reasons. One, it is because you proclaim to be Shia, true Shia. But obviously they were not Shias. They were lovers of the Ahlul Bayt, but they were not at the level for them to even call themselves as true Shias. Other is the obligations they had towards Allah, that they were sinning. And one of the other reasons, and this is what I wanted to show you, brothers and sisters, is that the Imam alayhi salam tells him that you watataha wa nuna bi'adhim huquq ikhwanikum fillah, that you neglected the great rights of your brothers that they had in God's eyes, that you neglected their rights. So we will be liable in the Day of Judgment, that we can be in a way that our imams are discouraged from our actions if we are not careful about our fellow brothers. But now a question I have is this, is should we treat all brothers in our community? Should we sacrifice our time and effort for all of them? Should we become friends with anybody that's in the masjid or in the mosque or the Islamic center? Well, for us to answer this question, we have to look at the narrations. The narrations give us a guideline about how to choose our friends. We should be very particular. A lot of times we allow our friends to choose us. When we look at these narrations, we should have the ability to choose our own friends. So what are some of the criteria for us to have true friends that we are going to be able to sacrifice for them, that we're going to give them our time and money? One of those characteristics that they should have is, when we look at from one of the traditions from Imam Ali alayhi salam, says your true brother is the one who forgives your lapse. If you find a brother that he forgives, sometimes you might become angry and you say, "I'm sorry." Your brother should be able to forgive your lapse. He fulfills your need. If you have a need, you need help, he comes and helps you. He accepts your excuse. If you explain to him why you behaved in this manner, he will accept it. He hides your vices. He doesn't zoom in into your faults. And he removes your fear and lives up to your aspiration. In another tradition we have from Imam Ali alayhi salam, a real brother is, he says, your brother is the one who does not abandon you in difficulty. Many people, when we test them, when we need them the most, we realize that they don't want to help us anymore. Test them to see when you have difficulty, will they come to your help? Does he does not forget you at the time of trouble? and does not cheat you when you seek his advice. So these are the characteristics that a true brother should have. And these are brothers that we should be, that they deserve our help and they deserve our time. And these are people that we should connect with and we should spend our time with. So in this month of Ramadan, we inshallah will be getting closer to our own community. And inshallah we'll be choosing good brothers for ourselves that have these criteria.
قال الإمام الصادق عليه السلام عليك بالدعاء فإن فيه شفاء من كل داء.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, I urge you to supplicate, for verily in supplication is a cure for every ailment.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah, ma lana rabbun siwa.
La ilaha
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
One way of thinking about the US military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by the US state's algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Scott Temke, author. This article is published under the heading West Africa, its latest testing ground for US military artificial intelligence. Stay tuned for more. One striking feature of U.S. military involvement in West Africa is the absence of an observable strategic vision for a desired end state. Nominally, U.S. presence in the region's multi-layered conflicts revolves around building security cooperation with state partners to improve counterterrorism capabilities, ostensibly providing protection to communities that states cannot. Concurrently, the U.S. military is typically the prime diplomatic entity for high-level bilateral engagements. The result is that the U.S. military is propping up the public authority of weak states, albeit in an ad hoc fashion that lurches from crisis to crisis. Regardless of the reasons for U.S. presence, there is hardly any deep public support for these operations. About 60% of U.S. citizens do not view these kinds of conflicts as a security threat, and more than 90% oppose U.S. invasions, even if weapons of mass destruction were in use. For the first time in recent memory, U.S. international relations scholar John Mearsheimer and Stephen Vogt write, large numbers of Americans are openly questioning their country's grand strategy. Even within the Department of Defense, these doubts continue to periodically arise. As former Defense Secretary Mark Esper testified in February 2020 to the House Armed Services Committee, conventional forces in Niger, Chad, and Mali need to go back to home so they can prepare for great power competition. Due to war fatigue, the U.S. has resorted to externalizing the strategic and operational burden of war to human and technological surrogates, creating what some scholars call a form of surrogate warfare. One example of externalizing the burden of the war to the machine is a tool created by Defense Innovation Unit and deployed at the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar in 2017. Throughout its deployments, this tool monitored and rapidly combined social media feeds in Syria before relaying that information to pilots and ground troops, who then used it to identify, track, and strike targets in that area of operations. General Joseph Votel, then commander of U.S. Central Command, boasted of the model's success and indicated that it would be replicated in future operations. In its preparation for great power competition, the U.S. military is modernizing its joint airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, that is, ISR, capabilities by exploring the uses of artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques for target identification. The final goal is to connect ISR sensors across all war-fighting domains, including space, air, land, sea, and cyber, directly with commanders and weapon systems, sharing data at an accelerated speed. In Niger, this project has materialized as the deployment of the new Block 5 variant of MQ-9 Reaper, a drone first used in Syria in 2017. The Block's fifth major upgrades include the ability to integrate and combine multiple data feeds, as well as to process this data more quickly. Since 2018, the U.S. has similarly armed their drones in Niger. In this fashion, West Africa joins Syria as a place that has become a testbed for this new wave of ISR technologies. The ISR modernization program follows prior U.S. military investment in the region with projects like the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership, a military aid package of $353 million. These military initiatives contribute to the African continent's status as a long-standing field site for experimentation that traverses the colonial and post-colonial eras. More recently, since the publication of the Burke Report, Africa has been a proving ground for the neoliberal thought that permeates development economics, advocating for structural adjustment policies while most foreign direct investment is concentrated in resource extraction economies. This thinking tended to stop well short of acknowledging the enduring damage done by colonialism on the continent. Niger's colonial experience was particularly vicious, with French military violence used to pacify the territory. This trend continued in the lead-up to Niger's 1960 independence, as French military forces suppressed opposition so the French state could consolidate control over uranium deposits discovered between 1957 and 1967 and other minerals useful for high technology industries. Today, uranium from French mines accounts for about 70% of Niger's exports, but tax exemptions mean that little of that value flows to state or its citizens. It is against this background that Niger provides a good case study of intersection between the rural poor's land struggles and U.S. military presence. Most Nigerians are subsistence farmers whose land tenure rights are insecure. The country is susceptible to frequent drought and severe food shortages, conditions which have been exacerbated by climate change. As of 2004, 9% of Nigerians, about 870,000 people, were enslaved or lived as bonded laborers. One way of thinking about the U.S. military's Niger operations is to see them as labs for warfare, testing new forms of observability and lethality guided by U.S. state algorithmic gaze, the components of which are built from the kinds of metals and minerals that are extracted from Niger's mines. Arguably, because of a strategic non-oversight, West Africa is conducive for testing these weapon systems and assessing how they form a kind of predatory formation that spans from the borders to the hinterlands of the world.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked and
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
کنم ما به 4-5 شکل نسبت به قرآن ادهان و سستی داریم.
We people take the Holy Quran lightly for several reasons. Sometimes we cannot recite the Quran properly. Now in this case, we can see many students and experts with various skills who are unable to read out the Quran properly. Dear brothers and sisters, just look at the last verse of Surah Muzzammil to see how important the position of the Quran is. In this verse, Allah recalls people one time about Salat and one time about Zakat, but two times about the Holy Quran. The exact wording is this: so recite as much of the Quran as is feasible. This sentence is repeated two times in this verse of the Quran. Now, dear youths, this verse and other verses show us the importance of reciting the Holy Quran. We also can listen to the recorded audio of the Quran in our cars or houses, and gradually we can memorize the Holy Quran. Even when we are in our workplace, whether a shop or a company, we can listen to the Holy Quran recitation, and it is very good if we listen to its translation in our mother tongue too. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasir Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website www.parstoday.com Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.